Rich Mullins, a Christian musician and songwriter, died in 1997 at the age of 41. But he once confessed in a concert, actually, in public, that he struggled with watching pornography while traveling alone. One night, while struggling with that temptation, Mullins picked up a notebook and wrote the words to one of his more popular songs entitled "Hold Me, Jesus." "And I wake up in the night and feel the dark. It's so hot inside my soul. I swear there must be blisters on my heart. So hold me, Jesus, 'cause I'm shaking like a leaf. You have been King of my glory. Won't you be my Prince of Peace?" With that backstory, some people have called Mullins' song the Prayer for Porn Addicts song. But really, it could be called a prayer for anyone in the world who is tempted, because this is the reality of temptation in our lives, of this spiritual warfare that we are involved in. Friends, Christ is the only one you can turn to when you are facing the powers of darkness and you are fighting the bondage of Satan. And Jesus teaches us in Luke chapter 8 that Christ's power frees us from Satan's bondage. The power of darkness is real. Rich Mullins certainly knew that in his own life. If you think about it and I think about it, we know it in our lives too. Sin draws us in, entices us, then traps us in the vice grip of spiritual bondage. And Jesus is more powerful than the powers of darkness. And he came to set us free from our bondage to sin. In Luke chapter 8, Christ confronts the domain of darkness. Luke chapter 8, verse 26 through 29. "Then they sailed to the country." Now, they've just had this storm on the Sea of Galilee. We talked about that last Sunday. They continue to cross, arrive in the morning in the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee, on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. "And when he came out onto the land, he was met by a man from the city who was possessed with demons and who had not put on any clothing for a long time and was not living in a house but in the tombs. Seeing Jesus, he cried out and fell before him and said in a loud voice, 'What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me.' For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man, for it had seized him many times, and he was bound with chains and shackles and kept under guard, and yet he would break his bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert." So Jesus and his disciples got off the boat that night after this incredible experience where Jesus stilled the storm in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. And they are immediately faced with this demon-possessed man rushing down the hillside to where they land. The man had one time been, I'm sure, a respected member of his own town, but he had left the city when he became demon-possessed to live in the country among the tombs. He was a scary person. And the people often tried to shackle him with chains, but he was so strong that he would break the chains and escape and head off into the cemeteries and the surrounding village, the surrounding hills. Demonic activity is powerful. The Greek word translated "possessed with demons" literally means actually that the man possessed demons, not that the demons possessed the man. For those of you who are Greek, it's an active voice verb here. He possessed demons. He had demons in his life. But the demons had come to control him because he had given them a foothold into his life. He had allowed them to take his life, and then eventually he lost control to the demons. And that is what happens with what we call demon possession. I prefer to use actually the term demonized or demonization. It's more accurate, I think, to the theology of the New Testament, demonizing or demonization occurs on a continuum. There is a range, if you will, of demonizing that takes place from, on the one hand, mild temptation, for demons, Satan is involved in temptation, to the extreme end, on the other end, where there is total domination. The man was at the extreme end of that demonization process. Now, let me just stop for a minute and be very, very clear. Demonizing is not mental illness. They are two different things. Rationalists today say that all demon possession was just a superstitious way of talking about mental illness in the ancient world. Not true at all. We must be very careful to distinguish between mental illness and demonization. They are two different diagnoses. There is, however, as we look at the text and that we look at this issue of demonization, there is an unseen spirit world in which a great battle rages between demons and angels all around us. It's all around us. It is very real. The Greek verb that Luke uses in verse 29 for commanding the unclean spirit to come out of the man, that Jesus commanded the unclean spirit to come out of him, that verb in its form actually means he repeatedly commanded the unclean spirit to come out of him. There was a horrible battle going on. By the way, the irony is this. You remember last Sunday when we looked at the storm on the Sea of Galilee and Jesus wakes up and he says one word, he says, "Stop." And the storm, the physical world, immediately, with one command, everything is still. And the irony here is that Jesus is repeatedly commanding the demon to come out of this man. Why? Because it is a battle. It is a spiritual battle between God and Satan going on for the life of this man. Jesus is confronting the powers of darkness that are tormenting this man. But in the end, Jesus proves that he is sovereign over the spirit world as well as the physical world. He is king, not Satan. Satan and his armies of demons seek to control this world and to destroy the image of God in humanity. Look, we are all made in God's image, male and female, we are in God's image. Demons seek to destroy God's image in this world. We are his image carriers, so they are after us too. Anything that is dehumanizing, degrading, has the devil behind it. Count on it. He is at work. Whether it is addictions, sexual practices, mental obsessions, if it is degrading and dehumanizing, the devil's behind it. Demonizing simply means that demons influence humans to live in ways that diminish the image of God. And you look at people who are controlled by horrible things in this world, and you are seeing the diminishing of the image of God. That's Satan at work in this world. At first, demonizing might simply take the form of a temptation. The demons influence us to start down the path. But as we walk along that path farther and farther, we end up in the garbage dump of life. As time goes on, demonic influence comes to control the person. Eventually, the person is living in a cage while the demons roam the minds of those people. Joe Taft is the founder of the Exotic Feline Rescue Center in Indiana. Joe's Sanctuary for Abandoned Wild Animals is the second largest in the entire nation. It provides a habitat, actually, for lions and tigers to live out their days peacefully in this world. When there's a new cub, they can't just leave it out in the sanctuary. It has to be hand-raised by humans. And tiger cubs apparently are very cute and very nice-looking. The problem is, what happens to tiger cubs? They grow up to be very big and very mean. You cannot tame a tiger. So in 2002, Joe was raising one of these cubs in his own home. They have to be hand-raised until they're ready to be put out into the wild. It was growing bigger and stronger day by day. But Joe was fully capable of handling this tiger cub. Everything was going fine until Joe had a heart attack and subsequently underwent quintuple bypass surgery. Suddenly, his own home became a very real threat to this weakened man. There was one thing he decided to do. He had a steel fence built around his couch in his living room. And Joe Taft spent the bulk of his recovery from quintuple bypass heart surgery lying on a couch in his living room with a steel cage around him, watching the tiger roam his own house. Pacing, roaring in Joe's house. All right. Now that's a picture. That's a picture of demonization. Comes to dominate your life. It reaches its ultimate conclusion, like in this man here, when it comes to totally dominate the human life. Well, Jesus came to free us from the bondage of Satan. Jesus came to rescue us from the powers of darkness. Paul wrote in Colossians chapter 1, verse 13, "For he, our heavenly Father, rescued us from the domain of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of his beloved Son." That's what he did for you. That's what he's done for me. We are transferred from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of the Son. We do not belong to Satan any longer. Christ confronts the domain of darkness, and he reminds us that Satan's power is limited by Christ's permission. Verse 30. And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. They were imploring him not to command them to go away into the abyss. Now there was a herd of many swine feeding there on the mountain, and the demons implored him to permit them to enter the swine, and he gave them permission. And the demons came out of the man and entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. We can't be certain of the location where this all took place. We know it was on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee. The traditional site is the village of Kersey on the eastern shore. This area has the steepest slopes on the eastern shore of Galilee. Our group, when we were touring Israel, toured this site. We visited this site in Israel. Like most every site in Israel, there's an old church. Every sacred site seems to have a church, and there's this old church located at the base of the incline. Then we walked up the path to a leveled out place on the side of the slope there. Look around. Now, nobody knows where exactly this took place. You're just sort of standing there looking around at the hills and the Sea of Galilee. Our guide told us that the water level of the Sea of Galilee was actually much higher in ancient times, so the water might have come up near the base of the cliff, and we're standing there trying to imagine this whole incredible scene from Luke chapter 8 and the other gospel accounts also. Jesus addresses the demon or actually he addresses the man here, and then the demon, and he asks him his name, and the demon speaks, and he says, "My name is Legion." Here was this man, totally miserable, totally tormented. He must have known his situation when he was lucid. He must have understood how repulsive he was. Just imagine for a moment being unloved, unwanted. He had family probably once, but they don't want to have anything to do with him anymore. Perhaps he even escapes into the wilderness because he doesn't want to hurt them anymore. It's a dramatic scene. Jesus looked into his eyes. He saw the wild fear, the anguish of this man so tormented by the demons in his life. And Jesus' heart went out to him, just as Jesus' heart goes out to people today who are tormented by the enemy, the addictions, and the horrible things that have taken control of their lives. Jesus looks into their lives too. He looks into their eyes. He loves them too. And he asked the man his name, Legion. Well, there are 6,000 soldiers in a Roman legion. I don't think he meant that there were 6,000 demons in his life, but he chose a name that indicated power and indicated many demons, certainly, that were involved in influencing him. It's a figurative term, I'm sure. But the demons had made a peculiar request of Jesus back in verse 28. See, they recognized him. They knew immediately who Jesus was. They recognized him, and they are afraid that he has come to torment them. The word means to torture them. Physical or mental torture is what's involved in their concern, their fear. Why would the demons be afraid that Jesus would torture them? Why would the demons fear torture? Well, the key to understanding that question is found here in verse 31. They were imploring him not to command them to go away into the abyss. Now, the abyss was the name for the temporary prison where God confines demons until their final torment, their final place of torment, is the lake of fire. But the abyss is the temporary confinement until that time. By the way, even Satan will be imprisoned in the abyss for 1,000 years when Christ reigns on this earth, according to Revelation chapter 20 and verse 1. And then he will be released from the abyss and wreak his havoc in this world. So the demons didn't want to be imprisoned in the abyss by the judgment of Jesus Christ. They knew he had that power, and they didn't want that. They feared the King of Kings. They knew then. By the way, demons know even now that he can send them to be tortured forever. They fear Jesus because he is sovereign. He is so powerful that he can end demonic activity at any time in this world. And so they asked to be sent into a herd of pigs grazing at a distance there somewhere on the hillside. And Jesus gave his permission. He allows them to do what they want to do. Here it is. Satan and his demons can do nothing in this world without the permission of Jesus, of God. God allows them, the text says, permits them. They asked his permission to have their way. Satan's power is always, always, always limited by God's permission in this world. God never ceases to be king. Jesus never ceases to be sovereign. The pigs, well, they run off the cliff. They're drowned in the Sea of Galilee. Rather dramatic end to this spiritual battle. I like the words of D.L. Moody long ago. He said, "My friends, you and I are no match. You are no match for Satan, me too. But when he wants to fight you, just run to your elder brother, who is more than a match for all the devils in hell." Where do you go when the enemy is attacking you? When the forces of darkness are trying to grab you, where do you go? Your older brother, Jesus. He's the one who can fight your battle for you. Now, it's very important to be balanced in this whole discussion, this whole understanding, to be balanced in our understanding of the spiritual war that is going on all around us in this world, the unseen war. We need a balance between fearing demons and denying demons. Satan wins if we go in either direction, to either extreme. I mean, some people become obsessed with demonic powers and live in terror of those powers. Others are very rationalistic and simply deny that there's any unseen realm at all. It's all just what we can see, feel, hear, touch. It's the physical realm only. Well, Satan wins either way. Either the terror-stricken or the denier. It doesn't matter. Satan's perfectly happy with either extreme. Satan wins if he can get us so obsessed with demons so that we sort of see demons behind every tree and around every corner, and our whole lives are obsessed with this topic and this issue. Satan wins then because we live defeated and in terror. Satan also wins when we ignore demons, when we deny that they have anything to do with life. And Satan is perfectly happy if we go to that extreme too. The truth is, we are in a war. We are part of the kingdom of light. And there is a war with the kingdom of darkness. It's a spiritual war. And demons are very real. But Jesus is more real. Jesus is the greater power. And we can turn to him to fight that spiritual battle. Do it sooner rather than later. Remember I said demonization is a continuum. When that first temptation comes, when that first peg in your life comes that they're trying to get a hold of you in some way, that toehold, that's where you better start fighting that battle right there. Because it's a continuum. And you fight that battle, the very first temptation, you fight it the same way you fight the end of it, by the power of Jesus Christ. There's no substitute. Satan's power is limited by Christ's permission. Third principle this morning, people reject Christ because he disrupts their lives. Verse 34. When the herdsmen saw what had happened, they ran away and reported it in the city and out in the country. The people went out to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone out, sitting down at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they became frightened. Those who had seen it reported to them how the man who was demon-possessed had been made well, and all the people of the country of the Gerasenes and the surrounding district asked him to leave them, for they were gripped with great fear. And he, Jesus, got into a boat, and he left them. He returned. All of this, of course, raises some very important questions for us. If Jesus has the power to end all demonic possession, oppression in, right now, why doesn't he do it? If he has the power, why does he allow satanic evil to continue to flourish in this world? If he can stop it right now. Don't tell me you've never wondered why God doesn't do that. I certainly have. Well, the answer to those questions, obviously hypothetical questions, but the answer is ultimately tied up with God's plan to bring greater glory to himself by allowing evil to run its course until the enemy is defeated completely at the time and place of God's choosing, not mine. In other words, I can't really answer that question entirely, but I trust that God's plan is the right one and that, of course, he is going to end evil one day. The question, why doesn't God do something, is different, however, than the question, why does God do something? I may not have the answers to the former question, but we do have the answer to the latter one, and that's actually the more practical question for us to ask this morning. The other side of the question is answered in this passage. Why did Jesus choose to defeat the powers of darkness here and not elsewhere? Why did he choose to come across, by his choice, to come across the Sea of Galilee to meet this demon-possessed man and free him? To cast out those demons. Why here? Why now? That's a much more practical question, because that's the question we face in our lives. Not why doesn't God do something there, but why does God do something here? The answer is found in the response of the townspeople. This is why. They were afraid. They asked Jesus to leave. Get away from us. We don't want you here. Why did Jesus defeat Satan in this place and at this time? I think there are at least three reasons, and these reasons help us understand what happens in our lives today. First of all, Jesus did it to prove his point. Look, the people's fear drove them away from God, not to God. And so it is today. People say, you've heard this, people say, look, if God would just eradicate evil in this world, if he would eliminate Satan and all the evil forces, then everyone would turn to God and be saved. Another way of asking that is, if God would just do some incredible miracle in this world, everybody would turn to him and be saved. It's not true at all, and here's the proof. These people didn't. I mean, they saw the man. He's clothed. He's in his right mind. He's normal. They could see the truth, the proof, the results of God's power. And what did they do with it? They still rejected Jesus. Jesus was proving his point, that even when God demonstrates his power over evil, humans do not believe. The same thing, by the way, will happen on a large scale in Revelation in the millennial kingdom, because Jesus is going to chain Satan for 1,000 years. He's going to place evil under wraps for 1,000 years. And what happens at the end of that 1,000 years? There's a whole bunch of people that refuse to follow Jesus after having perfection for 1,000 years. Why? Because that doesn't solve the problem. People have a warped value system. There's sin in us. These people had a warped value system. They loved pigs more than people. That's pretty much what it boils down to. Mark tells us in his account that there were 2,000 pigs in this herd. That's a lot of pigs. 2,000 pigs. And remember, pigs are not allowed in Israel. Now, we're on the Gentile influence side of Israel here, but they're unclean animals. These people were making a very good living off their pigs. And Jesus had hit them where it hurt the most, in their wallets. Jesus had disrupted their lives. And if they knew if they allowed Jesus to stay, he was going to disrupt their lives even more. No way! We don't want you here. We want our lives back. See, people don't want Jesus if he's going to disrupt their lives, especially if it includes their money and their possessions. Well, people today have warped values as well. People today reject Jesus because he disrupts their lives more than for any other single reason, I believe. We don't want to give up what we love about this life. We want to do what we want to do. Don't tell me what's right or wrong. I want to do what I want to do. We want to live as we want to live. And it's really as simple as that. So Jesus can do stupendous things, and people will still reject him because they don't want to surrender their lives to Jesus, even if they see the evidence of the power displayed before their eyes, because it disrupts the life they want. All right, we better move on. Secondly, Jesus did it to prove his power. The disciples and the demonized man needed to know that Jesus had the capacity to defeat the power of Satan, and we need to know that too. Sending the demons into the pigs and watching the pigs, by the way, he sent them into the pigs at the demons' request, remember. But watching those pigs rush off the cliff to their death, this is a stupendous object lesson for the followers of Jesus. It was tangible proof that Jesus would be victorious in the end, and that has to encourage them. This demonized man needed to know not just what had happened to him, but he needed to see what was happening. The disciples needed to see this object lesson so they would know. And we need to know that truth as well, because you and I face powerful, powerful problems, trials, struggles in life, because it's from a powerful, powerful enemy. Tearing apart our families, tearing apart our loved ones, tearing apart our situations and our circumstances. And we need to know something. We need to know, and we learn it from stories like this, we need to know that Jesus has the power to deal with it so that we can continue to walk with Jesus and to follow him. We are encouraged. Jesus has the power to defeat evil, and we can trust him. When we look into the eyes of a loved one who is tormented by sin, demonized by darkness of one form or another, we need to know that God has the power to change him or her too. That's the only way we can keep going in this rotten world. That's why. That's why we have stories like this. Jesus has the power to transform lives, to free people from the bondage of Satan. And we need to know that when the situation seems very dark and hopeless. And you face those situations. God's got it. Trust him. Third, Jesus did it to prove his plan. I think Jesus performed this miracle partially to prove his plan. He came because there was, he came across the Sea of Galilee now to meet this one demonized man. Why? Because he had a plan for that demonized man. That demonized man is going to become his missionary. That's what he wanted. The Lord went through all that to free a man he had already chosen to serve him as his missionary. I want you to notice that the same Jesus who said yes to the demons when they asked to be sent into the pigs, and the same Jesus who said yes to the people when they asked him to leave their region and leave them alone, is the same Jesus who said no to the man who wanted to go with Jesus. Why? He had another mission for that man to fulfill. Not all missionary work is performed overseas. He sent this man back into his own town, to his own people, with an assignment to preach the gospel, the good news of Jesus. Tell them about Jesus. That's your task. You see, Christ's no becomes our call to mission. Verse 38. But the man from whom the demons had gone out was begging him that he might accompany him. He wanted to go with Jesus. But he sent him away. No, you will not come with me, Jesus says. Return to your house. Describe what great things God has done for you. So he obeys. He went away, proclaiming throughout the whole city what great things Jesus had done for him. Sometimes God does not give us what we want in order to use us for what he wants. That's his plan. And Jesus tells us to stay to carry out his mission. Galilee Baptist Church is located in Gorham, Maine. We have a mission here. We have an outreach work group that is working hard on that mission. Get involved. If you'd like to go to the ABF on outreach. But get involved in reaching our town, our surrounding community. That's the Great Commission at work. The Great Commission is all about carrying on his work in this world until Jesus returns to establish his kingdom on this earth. This man, he sent back into his own town. Christ's no becomes our call to mission. Look, whether God says yes or whether God says no, he will still mean go. We always go. During World War II, General MacArthur was ordered to leave his army in the Philippines, take command of the Pacific forces fighting Japan. And of course, you're all familiar with the famous slogan or the famous statement that he made as he left. He said, "I will return," right? "I will return to the Philippines." Most of the army surrendered to the Japanese forces when they invaded, but many escaped into the jungles. They set up camps to help the Filipino people fight the Japanese army. Ed Ramsey was one of those men. It was a dangerous life. Many of the soldiers were caught, and when they were tortured and then executed by the Japanese. Ed Ramsey eventually became the commander of all the guerrilla forces in the Philippines. He had some 38,000 men and women under his command scattered about in the jungle camps fighting the Japanese. He became a wanted man by the Japanese with a price tag of $200,000 on his head. He had a few opportunities to leave the country, but he stayed to fight. Why? It was his mission. When MacArthur liberated the Philippines and Ed Ramsey was finally safe, MacArthur came back. He was down to 90 pounds of sickness and pain. Still fighting. Ed Ramsey trusted in the word of General MacArthur when he said, "I will return." And the 38,000 who served under Ed Ramsey in the Philippines trusted in the leadership of Ed Ramsey to fight their mission. Jesus promises to come back too. He's coming, but he gives us a mission to reach this world for him, to battle the forces of darkness. And in the long years of waiting for his return, we continue to faithfully carry out our mission in this world because we trust in his promises and in his power. Christ's power frees us from Satan's bondage. He calls us to commit our lives, to reach this world here at home and around the world to carry out his mission. That means it's very important that we each commit ourselves not to allow the enemy any toehold into our lives, anything to grab hold of, as the enemy is going to seek to demonize all of us. By that I mean anywhere on that continuum. Don't give him a toehold. Jesus wants all of me, not just some of me. Jesus wants all of you, not just some of you. The story is told of a Haitian pastor who told a parable to his congregation to teach this principle. A certain man wanted to sell his house for $2,000 there in the village of Haiti. But the man who wanted to buy it couldn't afford the $2,000. And so they negotiated. Eventually, the seller said, "Okay, you can have it for half price, but I retain one piece of ownership, this nail that he pounded in over the doorway. I own that nail." Some time passed. The seller wanted the house back. The buyer didn't want to sell it to him, refused, and so the seller went to the nail that he owned in that house, and he found the carcass of a dead dog, and he hung the dead dog on that nail in the house. And eventually, the buyer sold it to him back. Why? Because it reeked. But that was his nail. That's what Satan does. That's how Satan works. Don't give him a nail in your life. He will seek to control you as he did this man. But Jesus came to free us. No nails, nothing. He owns us. We are his. Father, help us to live that way in this world as we fight the powers of darkness by your power. And by your power alone. In your precious name, Lord Jesus, amen. We have a mission in this world.